Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 5th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on free speech in Europe and the United States. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we're pleased to welcome to host a special telephone conference call, and to tell you a little bit more about the topic and our speaker, I'm going to turn things over to Karen Lugo, who is a member of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Executive Committee for the Federalist Society. So, Karen, I'm going to turn the floor over to you, and we'll go from there. So, Karen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. I would first like to briefly introduce Lars Hedegaard and thank him for being our guest today. Lars Hedegaard is founder of the International Free Press Society. He's also founder and editor of Dispatch International. He also writes for the Gatestone Institute in the United States. And Mr. Hedegaard was prosecuted under the European incitement to hate laws all the way up to the Danish Supreme Court. But on a full court rehearing, he was unanimously acquitted of intending his comments for public dissemination. He then survived a terrorist assassination attempt exactly 2 years ago today. So today, Mr. Hedegaard is here to discuss with us why he has this deep belief that robust speech is vital to the survival of Western civilization. So thank you for joining us, Lars.
Well, thank you for having me, Karen.
Well, I have a series of questions for you, and I'm hoping to engage this discussion between Europeans and Americans that are interested in the protection of speech and in the and understanding challenges to our cultures. So the first question is, when record-breaking millions gathered in the plazas and streets of France and other European cities in solidarity, and when 5 million copies of Charlie Hebdo's subsequent issue with cartoon on its cover that answered the slaughter of 12 cartoonists and staff by Islamic jihadists, when that sold out before daybreak all across Europe, do you see that there is reason to expect a surge of support for more freedom of speech in Europe?
I don't know. It depends on what you're talking about. I have no doubt that most Europeans, the overwhelming majority of Europeans, are for free speech. The issue, however, is will the authorities, the governments, protect free speech? It's one thing that you have the right of free speech. Another thing is, will the governments protect it? And that is really the crucial question. I don't see that happening. What I see is that governments and the establishment are more eager to listen to and bend to the wishes of various Muslim Islamic organizations who try to undermine our free speech. When free speech was introduced in the European countries. In my country, it was a couple of hundred years ago. We thought that the enemy, so to speak, would be the states, the king or the government or whoever was in power. And to some extent, that is still the case today. But now we see that we are dealing with non-governmental organizations and movements who try to, by force of power, intimidation, terror, to silence free speech. And that's a new situation. And I would hope that the governments and the authorities, the police, etc., would clamp down on these extra governmental attempts to silence free speech.
Will you describe the court process as your case wound through the system and that the final determination was not necessarily understood as a a vindication of your right to speak, but only that you did not intend the remarks for public distribution. Is that correct?
That is true. I went through three court cases, lower court and intermediate court and Supreme Court. I was acquitted in the lower court and convicted in the intermediary court and then acquitted by a full panel of the Supreme Court under the leadership of the president of the Supreme Court. The basis on which I was acquitted was that my remarks had not been intended for public dissemination. Had they been intended for public dissemination, I would have been convicted. So your description is right.
It's interesting to consider that America has had a long legal tradition with what used to be known as the bad tendency doctrine, where criminal penalties were imposed for speech that just simply intended harmful consequences. But that doctrine evolved into the present legal test for criminal speech that considers speech punishable if it is likely to incite imminent lawless action. So abstract advocacy of violence is generally not punishable. And I understand that your remarks were not advocacy for a violent kind of action. But in the United States, in recent decades here, our Supreme Court has been very emphatic that there should be generous protection of political speech and speech on matters of public concern. When speech rights are judged according to the likelihood of provoking insult or offense, much power is given to the listener, and his complaints may serve to veto speech. So American courts now guard against what is called a heckler's veto, since large space is given to robust debate, even though it may be hurtful or offensive. Do you expect that the result of the Charlie Hebdo shootings will be an increase in self-censorship, since Europeans are generally not free to have the full-on debate in the public square without being potentially criminally liable for either racism, incitement to hate, or hate speech? And what has occurred is what happened. Do you think that this will translate into something like an assassin's veto over speech, where people will be afraid to exercise even what restricted rights they have to speak?
Well, what we have today in Europe is what you aptly describe as the so-called assassin's veto of speech, which means that you have the right to speak your mind, you have the right to speak your opinion. However, if you do that, you have to consider the possibility that some guy will turn up in front of your door with a gun and shoot you. I mean, what do? You have, in principle, you have a right of free speech. In practice, you have to consider whether or not you want to put your life on the line in order to express what you think. But I mean, apart from that, I think you're talking about the so-called Brandenburg decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, right?
Yes.
Which stated that general exhortations to incite violence, for example, if we want to kill all capitalists, are not punishable. However, if you say that let us meet on Thursday and kill the president of GM, for example, that would be immediate incitement, and that would be criminal. And I must say, I agree with that decision, and I applaud the American Supreme Court for upholding it. It means that you are not, you have a much wider scope for free speech in the U.S., and I would like the European countries to have a First Amendment, like you have. Unfortunately, we don't have that.
Are you more optimistic? And certainly you have shown a tremendous amount of courage and commitment to free speech in light of the attempt on your own life. Are you optimistic that these days that there will be more consideration by the legislatures for better protecting speech?
No, I'm not optimistic on that score. I don't see any, politicians in Denmark certainly talk a lot about free speech, but they don't walk the walk. They could abolish the despicable clause in our penal code called 266B, which was the foundation of my court cases. They don't want to do that because they are under the heel of the European Union. What I'm happy about is that I was meant to be dead 2 years ago. I'm still alive, so every day I live is a blessing.
And you're fighting on.
My next question.
In the United States, we have some very visible and hardworking reformist Muslims. Recently, a group of them, led by Dr. Zudi Jasser's organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, paid for a full-page ad in the New York Times, which denounced Islamism as a, quote, proven failure, and called for universal human rights, including freedom of conscience. They requested necessary support from non-Muslim allies and rejected all forms of oppression and abuse, particularly in the name of Islamism. If reformist Muslims like this call for, quote, an honest and critical reinterpretation of scripture and Sharia law, is there a chance of success when the host democratic culture supports an environment where scrutiny and criticism can provoke robust debate? Are there reformist Muslim leaders in Europe that might be encouraged by European solidarity around full and free inspection of Sharia zones that operate counter to European law and human rights norms?
Well, to begin with, I'm somewhat skeptical about the distinction between Islam and so-called Islamism. My position is that Islamism is Islam. I can find no distinction between them if you read the scriptures. If you read the Quran and the Hadith and the Sirah, etc., and pronouncements by Muslim holy men over 1,200 or 1,500 years, there is no distinction. What I just distinguish between is Muslims on the one side and Islam on the other. There are peaceful, democratic Muslims who will not engage in the undermining of our societies and democracy, who will not engage in violence or threats. But as an ideology, Islam is pernicious, dangerous, and should be criticized and opposed. So I beg to hesitate a bit when people say that they want to distance themselves from Islamism. What about Islam? And how can you change anything in the interpretation of the Quran or the Hadith as long as you believe that these scriptures are the words of God, Allah, and that Muhammad was the perfect human being whose actions and words should be repeated by any Muslim. I mean, if you want to go that way, you are going down the road of being an infidel or an apostate. And I wonder if these people are willing to go that way. Also, about your question of whether there are prominent spokesmen for Islam in Europe who would like to reform, so to speak, scripture and Sharia law, I haven't heard of any. In my country, a book came out last year by one of the guys who was behind the attacks on Denmark because of the Muhammad cartoons in 2005, 2006. His name was Ahmed Akari, and he was an imam. He has later apologized, and he wrote a book last year about the damage he did to the country. And he also remarked in his book that there's not one single so-called moderate mosque in Denmark. So the recruiting for various causes like the IS and similar outfits it takes place in the mosques. You won't hear a good word about our system of government and our free speech laws and anything in the mosques. So I sort of hesitate to believe it. Also on Egyptian television 2 years ago, one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood said that the only reason why Islam has survived for 1400 years is that we have systematically killed anyone who questioned the scripture. So they need to do a lot more than they have done if they really want to be part of Western society. And I don't believe that the rest of us who are not Muslims can do anything to support them. The revolution of Islam, which is certainly necessary, has to come from Muslims. You and I and others cannot do anything.
My next question, David Brooks wrote in the New York Times regarding the world's response to the Charlie Hebdo shooting that, quote, provocateurs and ridiculers expose the stupidity of fundamentalists. Fundamentalists are people who take everything literally. They are incapable of multiple viewpoints. They are incapable of seeing that while their religion may be worthy of the deepest reverence, it is also true that most religions are kind of weird. Satirists expose those who are incapable of laughing at themselves and teach the rest of us that we probably should, end quote. Why do you think that France has laws against speech that is considered offensive, yet it allows ridicule as expressed in cartoons and other satirical expressions?
Well, France has a certain history. You know that France was the colonial power in Northern Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, etc., and Algeria. And for that reason, France has had a long history of Muslim immigration to France. So I think that is one reason why they would take this position. But beyond that, I think that David Brooks is absolutely right. It is an emblem of Western societies that we accept ridicule, making fun of religions and peoples and ideologies. And it is also an emblem of Islam that they have absolutely no humor. They can't understand irony, and they will not accept that people laugh at them. We in the West have got used to the fact that we are being ridiculed and bad-mouthed. I mean, if when I open a newspaper in Denmark, I'm constantly being offended by something that I see or read. So what do? Well, I drink a cup of coffee and go about my work. I don't go to the police and complain that I'm being ridiculed or defamed or anything unless they lie about me. So that is a crucial difference between our Western culture and Islam. And I think it's about time that people understand what sort of hellish society we would be in if we couldn't make fun of each other, if we couldn't draw cartoons, etc. It's an old tradition in the West, going all the way back to classical Greece, that this is what we do. Sometimes those who make fun or try to ridicule others have to pay a price for it, but generally it's been accepted that, yes, we can do that. And this is what has upheld and promoted our societies. And this is also the reason why Islam is a failed ideology. I mean, look at the difference. Back in Roman days, North Africa and what is today Turkey, Syria, etc., were high culture areas. This was where people grew the corn to feed Rome. Philosophers existed there. Thoughts were thought. And how come they have all now degenerated into failed states or semi-failed states? My answer is it's because they have been taken over by a pernicious, dangerous, narrow-minded ideology.
My next question, French police have detained dozens on suspicion of supporting the Charlie Hebdo shooting. Twitter users were encouraged to report tweets that appeared to, quote, support the shooting, most using the Twitter hashtag #JSuisKouachi. Some have already been convicted. The president of the Representative Council of French Jewish Associations, Roger Kukierman, is reported to have accused Twitter of, quote, collaborating with the criminals, and criticized Twitter for not censoring the tweets. Many of the laws, like those in France, that give government the power to censor speech are based on the imperative of public order. Europeans generally place a high value on public order. Has this worked, and when is there clearly rejection of host country ideals in so, or when there is clearly rejection of the host country ideals in so many Sharia dominant zones, when that is proliferating in EU countries, how is the claim that public order trumps free speech sustained?
Well, public order is not a part of the, I think, Danish the Danish penal code. It is, however, enshrined in our constitution in the article about religion, freedom of religion. Anyone is allowed to serve God and pray to God in his or her own way, so long as nothing is taught or undertaken in contravention of good manners and mores or the public order. However, that is never really implemented. I've never seen a case to that effect. I do not support censoring Twitter or anything else. I think that we have to support free speech, regardless of how ugly and pernicious people express themselves. But of course, we are in a situation where the law, the writ of the law, does not run all over our countries. There are areas now all over Europe where Sharia law reigns. We have that in Denmark, in Sweden, Norway, Germany, Britain, France, you name it, and you are going to have it too in the U.S., as you probably already know. These are areas where the authorities, the police, the fire brigade, and others cannot enter without fearing for their lives. So you can write one thing in the law. You can write about all the good things you want to uphold, free speech, democracy, equality between sexes, etc., etc. But if you cannot implement the laws in various parts of the country, then where are you? I think this is a new situation. perhaps you could equate it with what happened to the Mormons in America. Back in, I think it was in the 1870s, the American Supreme Court said that multiple marriages were against the notion of democracy. And the federal government spent many years combating this phenomenon. We are in a similar situation now. We have areas in tiny Denmark where the police will not enter. The law will not run. So this is a quite new situation. It never existed before in Denmark. It started about 30 years ago. And of course, there's no free speech in these areas.
My last question for you, and Christian, I think that we were going to open the lines for audience questions after this. But my last question is, last week, an elected Texas legislator responded to news that several Islamic advocacy groups were going to visit Capitol offices by saying that when they arrived at her office, staff would be instructed to ask the delegates if they would, quote, renounce Islamic terror groups and publicly announce allegiance to America and our laws, end quote. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, a group initially linked to Hamas, issued a press release calling on the Texas Governmental Ethics Office to consider whether the Texas legislator had violated any rule. In this case, just the call to investigate whether public censure or reprimand is proper can be expected to deter others who may press a similar line of questioning. So even though American appellate courts uphold free and robust discussion, there are skirmishes outside of the courts that may serve to chill challenges to Islamist political action groups. In the EU, did, quote, incitement to hate laws begin with local government first taking such complaints seriously to the point of creating local speech regulations, or have the ordinances usually been generated at the state or EU level first?
Well, let me take your last question first. No, in Europe, it started with the UN, which passed a convention back in 1965 to combat all sorts of all forms of racism. And the leader in this endeavor was the Soviet Union and its dependents and some dictatorships in the Third World. Of course, you know why they did that, because they then had an instrument to jail and persecute people who criticized the Soviet order, or whatever order there was. To begin with, most Western countries, including Britain, Sweden, Denmark, and others, opposed this convention. But in 1971, it was nevertheless ratified by the Danish Parliament, and that became the paragraph 266B, which is a sort of rubber paragraph. That means you can prosecute anyone you want to prosecute, and you can also not prosecute people. if you look at Denmark, I was prosecuted for some remarks about rape in Muslim families, and later wrote a book about it called Muhammad's Girls, and it was well documented, and nobody had anything to say about the evidence of the book. A friend of mine, the Iranian artist Firozeh Basrafkan, wrote in the newspaper Jyllandsposten about the abuse of women and girls in Iran. Somebody wrote on Facebook, "I want to come and cut you up and serve you to the dogs. Was this guy indicted? No, he wasn't. Another guy wrote on Facebook that he wanted me dead. Was he prosecuted? No. So we don't have equality before the law. This sort of legislation invites differences between people. Whoever is loved by the press or the establishment goes free. Whoever is not loved by the press or the establishment is dragged into court. So what's to, for your other question, care, what they engage in is a so-called lawfare. They do not expect to win in court. They expect to deprive you of strength, funds. They want to tire you out. It's a war of attrition. That's how they do it. And I think that you Americans ought to be aware of this and perhaps strengthen the law so that groundless lawsuits should be kicked out of court.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.